My name is Kathy Camp, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me here. It sounded so simple when they called. It was great, and it's been great planning it. It's a real privilege to have my mom be able to attend with me. It's nice to know that she's also an active member of Al-Anon. The fruit basket was great. Just the treatment, the friendship, the love that has been shared has been fantastic. And I have to tell you this. I feel like the blue-collar speaker. I'm not a doctor and I'm not a lawyer. And that's okay. And so, you know, people have accused me of being sort of hardcore about things and sort of simple about things. And, you know, it's like sort of rigid at times. And I don't know, maybe my blue-collar approach to things has made it possible for me to be here. I tell you, Linda, I appreciate the introduction. I've heard a lot of people share when you talk about walking your program and living your program. You ought to see me in traffic sometime when I get a little frustrated. But the things that I'll share with you this morning are the things that I rely on. I in no way can practice this program in a perfect manner. I don't attempt to. I would not even want to try and tell you that I do. I have feet of clay, just like every other human being that walks around. The fortunate thing is that I do have a set of spiritual principles that I can turn to. And what I'd like to share with you is how I got to the point, first, of finding out about those spiritual principles. I grew up in an alcoholic home. Now, there's also another statement that I want to make here about growing up in an alcoholic home. I did not grow up in a dysfunctional home. It functioned just exactly like an alcoholic home is supposed to function. And there was no dysfunction there at all. And I have taken on people when they want to tell me that it was dysfunctional. Not at all. It drew us closer, and it kept us on a common path, and we knew exactly what the other person was doing, and we knew what the other people had on their mind, and we shared. Now, it may not be how you would want to share love or share a home with other people, you know, with other members of your family. It's certainly not the way we share today. But we were definitely close, and we definitely had a common goal, and we definitely had a purpose. Now, I grew up thinking that my father walked on water, and I grew up believing that whatever he said was true, and when he said things were going to be okay, they turned out okay. And whenever I was in trouble or whenever I needed something, you know, that reassurance, I always went to my dad. And he met everything that I needed at the time. The disease of alcoholism is a progressive disease. Now, I have to also tell you that just as my father drank, I was looking for something like that to look at. You know, I have to come to understand what's the nature of my disease. And I focused a lot of attention on what he did. And I focused a lot of attention on how he did things. And I also focused a lot of attention on being the oldest of four children. You know, I thought it meant that I came here with some power. And I thought it meant that I came here with the ability to tell people what to do and how, you know, and that I was supposed to look at what was going on in their life and that I was supposed to make sure that they were happy. And if we planned things, I thought it was my responsibility to make sure that the plan was carried out. Now, mind you that you never knew exactly what was going on in my head because I wouldn't tell you that. I just got angry when you didn't do it like I thought. I came here looking for this program. Well, the disease progressed. We moved around a little bit. We had lived in the state of Maryland, and we moved to North Carolina, and it seems that the drinking, everything just exploded in a short period of time. I mean, we knew all this stuff was going on, but we had major catastrophe, I guess, at our house. And we all hit a bottom at exactly the same time. Surprised the house didn't cave in because of that, you know. So we get to North Carolina. We had the rounds. I mean, just all the things that go on, all the turmoil that goes on in an alcoholic home, and we had excitement. And I loved that excitement. And I even helped stir it up most of the time, you know. I could identify with it, and it felt good. You know, I'm an event kind of gal. You know, and so I looked for those events, and we did a whole lot of things. Matter of fact, my dad in the later stages of his drinking was, I like to say, we sort of had Skid Row at home, And we had Skid Row in that all he wanted to do was drink. He didn't want any of us to bother him, and he was quite happy. He always knew where he always knew that, you know, that location that he was supposed to be in, I guess. Can't always say that he knew where he was. I always knew where he was, and I always knew exactly, you know, I knew if he was going to run out of booze and that kind of stuff because I kept an eye on it. And I kept track. And I kept track to the point where I couldn't work. I couldn't hold a job because the job required that I focus on something other than my father's drinking. And it required that I focus on something other than how I felt inside. And I couldn't do that. You know, I had a great job, and after 2.5 months, I had to quit. I mean, I couldn't do it anymore. They couldn't understand why I quit, and it was perfectly clear to me. So I had quit this job, and I'm, you know, living with my parents, and I'm old enough by this time to be out on my own, and, you know, they just couldn't quite get me out. I didn't really want to leave. And I couldn't leave because of what was going on at home. I felt it was essential for me to be there. I was so locked in to the disease of alcoholism that it was impossible for me to walk around and function in the outside world. And, you know, I did all the things that we do. I waited up. Well, where is he? And when he came home, the first thing I'd say was, why'd you come home? You know, and it, I mean, just none of it made any sense. So in this little town that we lived in North Carolina, there had been a conference of some type dealing with alcoholism. And they kept running a telephone number across the screen on the TV. And so my mom had me call the number. And it wasn't the number like you see today, you know, for treatment centers if you have a loved one who's drinking. I mean, it wasn't that kind of advertisement. So we called this number, and we went down and we talked to this gentleman, and we explained to him what was going on in our home. And he said, well, sounds like he might be alcoholic, but I can't say that. He said, but we have this for the families of alcoholics, or we have this for the families who have been affected by drinking, and it's called Al-Anon. Well, immediately I thought, you know, you get families together, we'd have a little potluck, and we'd trade some stories about what you did, you know, and this kind of thing. We could try some of the things that you had tried, and we could tell you some of the things we'd done, and, you know, that hadn't worked, that kind of stuff. And it would be, I don't know what I had in mind. Well, in February of 1969, we went to our first Al-Anon meeting. When they talk about alcoholics, you know, I've heard alcoholics talk about in their disease they take hostages. They don't hold the corner on the market because we take them too. We'd called up and gotten some support. You know, my grandmother had to come, and I mean, if we could have rounded up more family members, we would have. And we wanted everybody involved. I mean, this was, if we were having this, they were going to have it too. We were not shy about sharing any of this with anyone. Except the neighbors. You know, you don't tell the neighbors. Of course, they never understood some of the things that went on outside of that house, but you don't tell them. So in February 1969, we go to our first Al-Anon meeting. Now it's cold, we have jackets on, we have coats on, winter coats on, and we go in, and my mom says before we go in the door, now listen, keep your coat on, because if they say anything we don't like, we're leaving. Well, I'm real glad to tell you that we didn't leave. We weren't sure we were going to stay, but we did not leave that meeting. And I always marvel at what goes on in open AA meetings, in Al-Anon meetings, and in Al-Ateen meetings. You know, you cannot mistake what is there. I didn't know what it was, but I couldn't mistake that something was there. I had no idea how you lived your lives. I had no idea what was available when we walked in that door. I had no idea that it was hope and, you know, other things like that that we were walking into. But I could not mistake how the eyes looked and the fact that people laughed. Now, some of the things they were laughing at, I thought, this is sick. You know, something is wrong here. And as it turned out, it was sick, you know, but it wasn't anything wrong. And so we came to Al-Anon, and I said, I'm the oldest of four. And I think when they saw, I was 19 years old at the time, and when they saw four teenagers show up, we had an instant Al-Ateen group. And so we started an Al-Ateen group with the help of someone in the Al-Anon meeting there. And I went to Al-Ateen for several years. Now, I would like to tell you that I went to Al-Ateen with the same attitude that I go to Al-Anon with today, but that's not true. See, I came in full of anger and frustration. My greatest companion was fear. And I was going to, you know, it's just, I mean, fear just sort of oozed out of my pores. I mean, everywhere I went, and there was a tension about me, and I was hostile, and I was sarcastic. And I would say things to people that I didn't think, I mean, thinking back, it's, you know, sometimes if I think too much about it, it can almost embarrass me, and I wonder why they let me stay. Until I have someone, a newcomer, come in the door with the same attitude, and we know exactly why they stay, and we let them stay, we want them to stay. It's almost like the more hostile they are, the more we love them. It's like, come on, let's do this thing. But what I want to share with you this morning is not what went on before and not what got me here, but what I have found since being here. I would like to share with you my program of recovery. Now, as I shared earlier, these are my opinions. These are the things that I turn to. These are the things that I rely on, and I do not do them perfectly. They're a set of spiritual tools. And as I share with you about them, you know, I often think about the common thread. And I was thinking, you know, just recently and listening to people share, and when you think about a rope or you think about a thread, there are strands that make up that thread. And for me, it's a spiritual thread. And so the strands at any time can take on a different meaning. They can be different things. Oftentimes for me, it's change, because that's what this program has meant for me. Oftentimes for me, a strand in that thread is courage. Oftentimes it's faith. Oftentimes it's trust. And there's a way that I have found those things, and there are times and there are tools that I can use so that I can experience those things in my life. I cannot tell you a way to do this once and have it last forever. If that was the case, we wouldn't be here. I do not have any magic answers. I don't have, you know, no one waved the wand, and I tell you what, if they start talking like they're going to wave one, I go sit in a chair because I want to make sure if it's going to happen, I want to be there. But I would like to share with you about the steps that, the design for living, as you all call it, that I try to live by. And the first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, but our lives had become unmanageable. Now, I believe that there's two parts to this step. When I first came here, I just wanted to go sit on the hyphen. I didn't want to admit that I was powerless over anything, and I for sure didn't think my life was unmanageable. I mean, I knew exactly what was needed. And the very first part of the first step lets me know the nature of my disease. You know, we hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous talk about the phenomena of craving. You have a drink, and the phenomena of craving sets up, and you want more of the same. Well, I have to tell you, I've never experienced it that way, but I have my own phenomena of craving. Let me get one obsessive thought, or let me even think I need to look at your life and have an opinion on it, and I am off to the races. I want more of the same, and I will go to absolutely any length to get it. I don't care who I step over, I don't care who I run over, I don't care where I have to go. I will have more of the same. Now, I also have to tell you that, you know, the traditions play a real important part in my personal life. And the first part of the first step, actually, the second part of the first step, lets me know about Tradition 10, you know, no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. I guarantee you, when I have an opinion on your life, we're going to have public controversy because I just have to tell you. You know, it's just something that's there. So I understand about the disease because that is something I have absolutely no control over. I cannot stop myself from having an obsessive thought. We were powerless over alcohol. There was absolutely no way, when I knew that alcohol was in our home, when I knew that it was in the store, and I'd drive by the store and have the same thought. When I knew it was in a store and he might go buy it, I had the same thought, that obsessive thought, and it ate me alive. My personality changed. You know, everything that I hear members of Alcoholics Anonymous share about, it's like I had it and I never even had to swallow anything. I don't know which is better. But when I look at what's the nature of my disease, and when I recognize that the nature of my disease has absolutely nothing to do with another human being. My father never told me, feel this way. He never told me, look at this. He never told me, worry about. He certainly never told me, pour anything out. You know, he never told me to do the things that I did. The disease, it's all in here. I mean, I lived by my head. It told me what to do. I was controlled. I had to have it. And until I had another answer, I kept marching down the same path. So it took me a while to understand. about the nature of my disease, but when I was able to do that, then I was able to admit that I'm powerless over it, and there's nothing that I can do. Now, I would like to share with you that being powerless over alcohol does not mean that I have failed. And the first step in no way indicates failure on anyone's part. For me, it becomes a fact. For me, it's actually honesty. And then when I looked at the second part of the first step, and I heard this gentleman share about, you know, this is where the ism comes in, the I, self, and me disease. You know, I am so self-centered that my life took on a different dimension sometimes, it felt like. I was so self-centered in my thinking and in my actions that I actually thought that my father, my mother, my friends, members of the family, that people should do what I wanted them to do, and that they should do it the way that I wanted them to do it, and that if they would only mind and do things my way, then I would be fine. I would be happy. And so when I look at the I, self, and me disease, you know, I understand just exactly how unmanageable my life had become. Now, one of the things that the first step points out for me is that I was absolutely void of any type of spiritual understanding, spiritual thought. You know, I had decided a long time ago that if God existed, that he certainly wasn't paying any attention to our family because we were different. You know, I grew up feeling like I was different from everybody else. And I never knew what I could do to feel like you. You know, I was sure there was an X on the top of the house. Say, hey, you know, and we're not, these people have made me mad, and so I'm not going to do. And so I believed that, actually I didn't believe, I had nothing spiritual about me. I had nothing religious about me. It was, you know, there wasn't anything there. And the first step creates a big void in my life. You know, the first step, it relieves me of a lot of things. Now I have to tell you, one of the things that it relieved me of, and that I'm real grateful for, is blame. I cannot blame anyone else for the outcome of my life. As a matter of fact, not only do I not blame them for the outcome of my life, I don't want somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, I'm sorry for what I did here, and if I could change the past, I would. I don't want anybody messing with my past. I'll tell you why. You go back and you mess with my past, you change something back there, and I might not be here today. And I don't know about you. I mean, as nervous as I am this morning, I don't know about you. I still don't want to trade places with anybody else today. I don't want to go back and have anything in my past changed. So I don't have to blame anyone. I'm not an adult child. I mean, sometimes I act like a child, and that's okay. But I'm not an adult child because I'm not tied to the actions or the activities of anyone else in my family. And it's certainly not my parents' fault. And I'm real grateful for that. And the first step gave me that. And then the second step, you know, you have this big void, and the second step was the beginning of filling that up. And I tell you, there are times when the second step just literally takes my breath away. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. You know, it talks about when you're coming to believe, and it talks about what are the things that are essential for us, and it talks about us being able to lay aside our prejudices, you know, the old ideas that we have. And when I think about the power of this second step and what it has meant in my life and what it continues to mean in my life, I mean, this is change. This was change for me. This required that I have an open mind. This also required that I be willing to let go of all of my old ideas. I have to tell you, my best thinking got me here. When I became honest, open-minded, and willing, when I realized that I needed what you had, the second step was like a lifesaver. Because if my best thinking got me here, the second step gives me the opportunity to put that best thinking down and start developing new thinking. You know, in that coming to believe, and I have to tell you that, you know, the higher power, the God that I believe in today, is so fantastic and is so much a part of my life. I mean, that's what makes me nervous when I stand up here. How do I share with you what happened to me and let you understand? How do I share with you the power that has come into my life as a result of this program and have you understand that? I'm not smart enough to articulate it in a manner that you would be able to know exactly what has gone on. Now, what I do believe about this program is that each one of us share, you know, we could all just sort of nod our heads because it happens to all of us. And so this second step, this coming to believe, it meant that I was able to change. And it meant that I was able to have hope. When I came here, you know, at 19 years old, I thought, it's over, you know, it's done. This is the way it's always going to be. Nothing's ever going to change. And all I'm going to do is be relegated to this life of, and then, you know, it was fill in the blank. Now, typically it was like, you know, I never said I'm relegated to a life of obsessive thinking. I mean, I didn't think that. I thought I was relegated to a life of being miserable because you just wouldn't do it the right way. And so this coming to believe. And I have to tell you that as this coming to believe is a part of my life, I look at the second tradition when it talks about the ultimate authority. And this coming to believe in the ultimate authority, and guess what? Nowhere does it say that I come to believe in a better me. Nowhere does it say that I come to believe in, you know, a higher self, me. It doesn't say that. You know, it says that there's an ultimate authority, and that one is God. Now, I also have to tell you that that second tradition saves me from a lot of conflict with other people, because it says who the ultimate authority is, and I don't know about you, but the copy of the traditions that I look at, my name is not in there. You know, and so it's like, it makes it just real simple. It makes it real simple. And so I come to believe in a higher power that can restore me to sanity. You know, and I believe that it becomes an action. It becomes a practice. The things that I do so that I can live in a sane manner. I do things that would appear insane at times. You know, and I'm sure if other people walked in my skin, they would think, you know, you're crazy, Kathy. And then there are things that I can do and it's, you know, you feel perfectly calm. But you know what the insanity is for me? The insanity is not what I did when my father drank. The insanity wasn't what I did when I thought my mother or my brother and sisters were unhappy. That wasn't the insanity. The insanity was that I thought I even needed to look. That was the insanity. The insanity is the very nature of my disease. Being restored to sanity means that I am relieved of that disease. And that I can be relieved of that disease real simply by just asking to be relieved of it. And so, you know, the second step you start building. For me, I did. I started building this relationship with God as I understand him. And I get to the third step, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, you know, when I first came here, I thought, whoa, you know, I was a person who wanted to be in control, but I couldn't decide anything. I lived with constant fear. I lived with constant uncertainty. If you ask me, I was so focused and so self-centered in what was going on in the disease of alcoholism. If you ask me what I thought about the weather, I couldn't even tell you because I had no opinion. I had no opinion because I hadn't paid any attention. I had no opinion because I didn't even know how to look at it. And here we come to the third step, and it's asking that we make a decision. It's offering me an opportunity to make a decision. I don't know about you, but for me, that was huge progress that I was even willing to do that. And when I look at it now, you know, make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I believe that the third step is a preparatory step. It's getting me ready. You know, it's getting me ready for what comes in the remaining steps. And it gets me ready, and I love the prayer that we can say for that. You know, I especially love the part that says, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I'll tell you why I love that, because that's the sentence I always want to leave out. And I can tell you there have been mornings and there have been times when I have said that prayer and I leave that sentence out and it's like, whoa, wait a minute. Wait a minute. The very thing that causes you the most problem is the thing you need to be relieved of. You know, and if I look at what is it that this program offers me, it's an opportunity to put me, to get that ego, that part of me aside so that I can live a different way. And I have been attracted to this program. I want to do this because of how I see it work in your life, and I want to do it now because of how I've seen it and felt it work in mine. And so the third step's getting me ready. You know, when we talk about take away our difficulties, you know, and so it's like, I mean, the third step just gets you ready for the fourth one. I just can't deny it. Take away my difficulties, and it talks about victory over them, and guess what? I mean, it ends so that, you know, so that I can do your will, God. And I, you know, that if I have trouble with the third step, if I have trouble with the God that I understand, for me it's simple. I go back to the second step and I look at what did I come to believe in. And at no point did I ever come to believe in myself. Now, the sixth tradition also comes in here for me because it talks about lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary spiritual aim. If I have trouble in any one of those steps, all I have to do is look for money, property, and prestige, and I guarantee you, those are the things that make up myself. Those are the things that make up my ego. And those are the things that will drive me into, you know, you want to talk about going, you know, into the gates of hell. Those three things will do that. Because it's those things that I hang on to and that I can't get enough. When I'm in self, I can't get enough of those things. When I think about the freedom, that comes as a result of that. You know, I made this decision. I can say, God, here I am. And then I can say the little third step prayer, and I can move on to the fourth step. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I told you that fear was my greatest companion when I got here. You know, there are times when I can look at the fear in my life and welcome it like an old friend, because it's a companion. I know what it's like to be afraid. I know what it's like to have, you know, it's like, talk about a compulsion. I have to be afraid of something, you know, and so I just carry it with me, that compulsion to have fear. And here all of a sudden in the fourth step, I'm able to make a searching and fearless moral inventory. I never did anything without fear. Never. And I think this step gets a bad rap. You know, I think this step, a lot of people say, oh, it's terrible. They'll tell you it's horrible. I can't do it, you know. And I don't believe that. See, I don't believe it because I have been able to take the first three steps in my life. And I can make a fearless moral inventory of myself. And I make this fearless moral inventory not because myself is with me, but because the God of my understanding is with me. I ask in the third step, take away my difficulties, and the God of my understanding has provided me a vehicle to do that very thing. And in doing that, you know, I look at the fear and the anger and the resentment, and I'm able to look at how the world and it says? The world and its people dominated us? You know, and that's exactly what went on for me. And so I can say, God, you know, you're in charge here. Guide me as I do this. And I know that the guidance is there. And then I recognize, I mean, why is it that we do the fourth step? You know, it makes it very clear and very simple. It says that the reason we do the fourth step is so that we can recognize that only God can remove our self-will, those things that have blocked us off from Him. I did not know when I came here that the problem I thought I had in my life was a spiritual or lack of spirituality. I didn't know that that was the problem. I came here thinking the problem is my father. The problem is, and it was always something out here, and the problem is. And so when I'm able to be honest with myself and open-minded and willing and say, okay, God, let's, you know, I want to do this. I don't know about you, but there are times when I can't live with me, and I have to do what it says here. And what is it that I find? You know, this is one more part of that, one more strand in that common thread. It took courage. You know, I will tell you it takes courage to take the fourth step. But I also will tell you that it takes peace. And I have been, whenever I take a fourth step, I'm able to be at peace with myself because I know that I'm not running the show here and that the God of my understanding is. And then what happens? I mean, this is what happens. I'm able to go to the fifth step, admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And I have to tell you, when I came here, you know, I already shared with you that my father was my idol. He was the person that I looked to for the answer to, you know, everything. And I often have had times with, you know, getting my priorities straight, and this step helps me remind me of my priorities because it says admitted to God. It lets me know that that's where I go first. You know, how many times have I thought, I got to go talk to this person, I got to do this, I got to do this, I got to do this, instead of taking just that moment and saying, okay, God, here it is. And by that admission to God, it lets me know that God is the being that has power to help me. God is the being that has the power, that has paid attention. God is the being that has provided us with this program. God is the being that will remove those defects of character from me. And then it says, admit them to myself. And when I admit them to myself, I can do it without being ashamed of what I have done. I can do it without fear. I can do it without judgment. And when I can live my life and not judge me, I'm living my life and I'm not judging you. You know, how many times the next part when it says to another human being, I don't know about you all, but I have a should maker that lives in my house. And this should maker gets in here and says, well, this is what I did that I should have done or I should do. And by admitting it to another person in this step, it keeps that should maker from being in control. Not only does it keep the should maker from being in control, it keeps the should maker from even participating in my life. Because it's not a question of should. You know, this says the exact nature of our wrongs. There isn't any better expression of honesty, of open-mindedness, and of willingness than when we share the exact nature of our wrongs. These are the things that I did. These are the things that made me, that make me up. And guess what? You know, we were just sure when we were taking the fourth step, you know, have you ever thought, I'm going to take the fourth step and the fifth step and somebody's going to, you know, they're going to judge me, they're going to brand me, and they're going to kick me out the door. And I've been in a lot of meetings and I've heard a lot of people share, and I've never heard one person say, after I took my first step, they kicked, or my fifth step, they kicked me out. You know, we just don't do that. That's not what this is all about. And so I look at what is it that it brings into my life, and what is it that it brings to me spiritually. And it's an expression of the presence of the God of my understanding in my life when I can admit it to Him, to myself, and when I can share with another human being. And then we move on to the sixth step. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, you have that one little thing you just want to hold on to. You know, it's like, I don't know if I can live without that. You know, I have to hold on. You know, God, I know I'm supposed to be honest, and I know that, you know, I'm not supposed to have fear, but God, I need to have just a little bit of fear. You know, I need to have just a little bit of that ego. And I, you know, there's something that you want to hold on to. I mean, there was for me. And I think about what's happening in this sixth step. You know, if I really am honest with myself, and when I sit down and I look at what occurred in the first five steps of this program, it makes sense that the sixth step is written the way that it's written, and it has the words in it that it has. When I came here, without knowing it, I wanted change. I had no idea what the change would be, but I wanted change because I lived in a world of hopelessness. I believed that life was over when I was 19, that this was it, it would never be any different, and that I was doomed. I wanted change. I just didn't know what to do or how to do it. And you attracted me to this program. Now, I also look at, you know, our 12th tradition and our sixth step. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And we talk about in our 12th tradition anonymity being the spiritual foundation. It doesn't say here that I need to go find somebody else to remove these defects of character. It doesn't say that I am going to be the one to do it. If I look at the anonymity being a spiritual foundation, the God of my understanding doesn't care who's praying to Him. The God of my understanding doesn't care who's becoming willing to have all these defects of character removed. He just wants somebody to be around. That's all. He doesn't care that I don't have a lot of degrees. God doesn't care that I'm not a doctor or a lawyer. He's not worried about that. But God does care about me and every single one of us who come into this fellowship. And He does care about us becoming closer to Him. So when I can say we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character, you know, I developed a new friendship in the second step. And I turned my will and my life over to the care of that God in the third step. And I let that God guide me through the fourth step without fear. And I was able to admit to that God in the fifth step. So in the sixth step, why wouldn't I be ready to let God remove those things? He's already demonstrated to me that He has the capability and that I don't. I guarantee you, I never did anything without fear. Yet I just shared with you that I took a fourth step without fear. Why wouldn't I want God to remove those defects of character? Now, the simple reason at times that I don't want God to remove them is because I'm getting something from it. What's my motive? You know, that money, property, and prestige. What's my motive? Why am I doing this? Why am I trying to hang on to it? And I guarantee every time I try to hang on to something real tight, every time I get wrapped up in that money, property, and prestige, I immediately trade places with God. I put something else above Him. And so the sixth step is a real good, not only reminder, but expression, and a step for me to practice this relationship with my higher power. And then when I'm ready, and it says that the key is that we only be willing, and when I'm ready, then I get to the seventh step. Humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. You know, if I think about one step, I mean, where does it happen for me? It happens in the seventh step. And what is it that it says? My Creator, I'm now ready that you should have all of me, the good and the bad. Take away every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. At no point does it say that I need to further the personality of Kathy Camp. At no point does it say that I need to try and rise above you. At no point does it say that I am below you. At no point does it say I will decide what stands in the way of my usefulness to the God of my understanding and to you. I have absolutely no idea. You know, as I prepared to come down here this morning, I had no idea. I mean, I knew what I would generally talk about, because it seems that, you know, I always share about the steps. But I didn't know all the little things that were going to come out, because I said, God, this is in your hands. You know what I have found. You know where I found it. And so the message becomes my higher power. Now, if I tried to stand here and impress you, if I tried to tell you I have this and I have this and I have this, if I got wrapped up in money, property, and prestige, then the message that you would hear this morning would have absolutely nothing to do with the God of my understanding. It would have only to do with the further of me. And the seventh step, I love this step. I love this step. I love that prayer. You know, there are times in my job things will get a little tense. And I love being in, and I'm in sales, and I love being in the middle of a customer presentation and having this prayer flash through my mind. I love knowing that I have this to turn to, and because I have this to turn to, I do not have to be afraid. And I know that the God of my understanding knows me better than I know myself. And I know that when I turn my will, when I say, God, I can't do it, and when I say that little prayer, then I know. You know, it's like I can feel it inside. And I know that God will take away from me the things that he thinks need to be taken away. I know that he will do that, and it's not up to me. I don't know about you, but I came here feeling responsible. And it's like, I don't have to be responsible. Now, it doesn't mean that I sit back and say, gee, God, I'd like a meal, and he's going to shoot it to me. You know, no. My responsibility is that I do the footwork. My responsibility when getting to the seventh step, I mean, this, I don't know about you, for you all, but this is where it has happened for me and where it continues to happen for me in the seventh step in turning my life over to this God, this higher power, and having done the things at the first six. I don't have to be responsible. There are things that I do responsibly. You know, I get up and get dressed and go to work every day. I get up and make sure that I have contact with the God of my understanding every day. My responsibility is that I read the literature. My responsibility is that I be willing to share this with you. My responsibility is that I go to my meeting. My responsibility is that I pick the chairs up in the literature. You know, whatever it is that's required, that I do that. That's my responsibility. But the God of my understanding will take care of. You know, that's doing the footwork. And so I love the seventh step. I also love that it's the step that there's probably the least amount written regarding it, because it becomes very personal, and it becomes very close. And it just becomes, for me, it's like life-giving. It is absolutely life itself in the seventh step. And so what happens on my spiritual journey after I say this prayer, then I get to the eighth step, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. You know, I told you I had a should maker. Not only did I have a should maker, I got a guilt maker. And I carry guilt, you know, I mean, that was just a great, I wore it like a heavy winter coat. You know, let's get in here. And in making this list, I know that one more time that it is guided by the God of my understanding. And that the key here, making this list, the key is being willing to lay aside myself. My being willing to put down my ego. My being willing to change my motive. My motive for making this list is not to put people on there that I want to impress or that I want to win back as friends or family. That's not what it's about. It's being willing to say, okay, God, I ask you in the seventh step. I said, here I am, and it's being able to take his direction and follow His direction and follow the expression of what His presence in my life has meant. And so I make that list and I become willing. And you know, I'm always amazed. I mean, I'm just always amazed. If you look throughout our literature, there are like three words that show up everywhere. And it says, you know, we ask God to relieve us of self-pity, dishonesty, self-seeking motives, you know, those kind of things. And it just shows up, if you read the literature, it just shows up for, you know, all of the steps. And that's what the eighth step in making that list is all about for me. I don't want to do it my way, because my way got me here. I'm willing to have a different perspective. And so then I can move to the ninth step. May direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Yeah. You know, when it first time I went through this and I looked at this step, you know, I asked God to let the person know that I'm sorry. Now, I know that going up and saying I'm sorry to someone is not making an amends. That's not, you know, an amends for me is how do I live my life now in regards to that person. And so I still do. I ask God to let that person know that I'm sorry, because when I do that, my attitude changes. That cloak of guilt that I had in the eighth step, the ninth step allows me to take it off and put it down. And I no longer have to go and pick it up. It also lets me know that the outcome for this step is in God's hands. You know, when I first came... Oh, I'm glad I had a chance to make amends to my dad a long time ago for this. When I first came here, I used to make a list of people that had hurt me, and then I would tell them about it. And I would tell them about it when there was a crowd, more people around, you know. And I don't know about you, but I wanted step 8 and 9 to be 1 and 2. Because I hurt and it's like I'm going after them. You know, I'm gonna get them. It's real nice to have the ninth step be the ninth step. Now, I know that my personality started to change the first step. I know that. And it changed throughout. The ninth step is where I have an opportunity to demonstrate to people in my life how I can live and what has changed in me because of this relationship that I have with my higher power. This step also lets me know when I need to just keep my mouth shut and not say anything to them. This step lets me know that I'm not doing this step to hurt somebody else. I'm not doing this step, as I said, to have a fan club. I'm doing this step so that I can live freely within my skin and walk among you without the fear and the guilt and the degradation that I carried before. That's what it's about. And it doesn't mean that I immediately run to everybody and say, gee, I've developed this relationship with God and my understanding, and here's what I think you need to do, and you need to have this. That's not what it's about. It's about saying, here's what I did, and then demonstrating, here's how I live. You know, if I just went and said to them, here's what I did, and I kept doing the same old thing, and my attitude didn't change, it wouldn't mean much. And I certainly wouldn't be able to go to sleep at night. And I tell you what, you know, the things that I know need to be in this step, the people that I know I need to make amends to, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, do you ever wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, you got the heebie-jeebies, and somebody's name or face or something you did flashes through your mind? I don't know about you all, but it's been a while since I've had those, and I sure don't want to go back to living that way. You know, where you wake up and you're just, it's like you're having sweats, and you know it's because of something you did, you know, and it's that moment of clarity where you know you did it. And so this ninth step is the ability and the opportunity for me to put down all those things that I wanted to run away from. You know, I've had the chance to face them right square on, and say, here's what I did. I admitted it to someone else. I've developed this relationship with God in my understanding. And now in the ninth step, I'm able to say, and I'm able to demonstrate, here's what has happened in my life. And as I said, it tells me the outcome is in God's hands. I don't have to worry about it. I have to be willing, and I have to be open-minded, and I have to be honest. And then the tenth step, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, there's something that's real strange for me about this 10th step. Now, you know, in a piece of literature that I read, it says that we are now in the Spirit. And I have to look at it, and it says, continue to take personal inventory. It doesn't say anything about God in this step. It didn't say anything about God in, you know, 8 and 9. But it doesn't say anything about God, but here in the description and the explanation and the things that I'm supposed to do, it tells me that I'm now in the Spirit. I have to tell you that by the time I get to the 10th step, and as I practice it in my life, it means that something changed. You know, that spiritual thread that I have been developing, that spiritual thread that is in my life, I have a chance to experience and use on a daily basis in this 10th step. And it says that we now will grow in effectiveness and understanding. Well, my effectiveness, you know, it also talks about a daily reprieve. My effectiveness is about 30 seconds sometimes. But I know where to turn. I use the 10th step as the quality control aspect for my program. As I'm taking the 10th step and practicing it throughout the day, it will point me in the direction of, if I'm becoming obsessive about something, or I think I want to become obsessive about something, it will point me right to, what did you learn in the first step? And when it points me to that, then I know what to go and do. And I know how to let go of an obsessive thought. I know how to let go of the need to even want to obsess, because you all have taught me that. And so the 10th step allows me to practice all the things I've learned in the previous 9 throughout the day. I don't have to, you know, hold it. I don't know about you all, but I'm dangerous. You leave me alone for about 5 seconds in my own head and in my own thinking, and I'm going to get in more trouble quicker than any other time. And so I have to have something to hold on to, and I have to have something to guide me throughout the day. And guess what? You know, I was very confrontational with people. If you told me the sign said stop, I'd say no, it says go. Whatever position you took, I was going to take the opposite. It didn't make any difference if I believed in it or not. And I fought with everybody. You know, it's like, let's get this mental bantering going. Let's just get in there. And here in the 10th step, it tells me that I no longer have to fight with anybody about anything. And there's only one reason, because the previous 9 work, and because I have a God that I believe in and that I can turn to. And I love the 10th step. But guess what? It also talks about self-pity and selfishness and dishonesty. You know, don't get caught up in those things again. Nowhere does it say, Kathy, go let your ego flourish. You know, it just never says that. So then the 11th step, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. One more time, here I'm given a tool. Now see, when I came here, I didn't know. Like I said, my best thinking got me here. I did not know that you could have prayer. I didn't know that you could have communication with God. And that's what prayer becomes for me. Now I thought, you know, when I first heard people talk about prayer, I thought they meant all this formal kind of stuff. And I'm not a formal kind of person. And so I was confused for a while. But the confusion slowly went away as I listened to you share how you communicated with the God of your understanding. And I watched what you did in your life. You know, and it tells me the prayer and the meditation. It tells me the time when I'm talking and when I'm listening. Now again, I'm not, you know, there isn't anything formal that I do here. The key is that I am willing to say, okay, God, you know, here I am. Here's what's going on. What do you think? It means that when I seek through prayer and meditation, it means that if I'm confused about something and I don't know what to do, I don't. Now, it doesn't mean that I can't use that as an excuse not to do what I need to do. But I can, when in doubt, you know, don't. When in doubt, sit calmly. I can do that. Because that's what the 11th step tells me. And it's through prayer and meditation. I don't know about you, but you know, when you first meet a new friend, and it's like, you know, it's somebody you want to get to know. And you meet this new friend, and you exchange names. And then the next time you meet them, and you think, I can't wait to go talk to this person. And you see them again, and you share more about yourself, and you hear more about them. Well, that's how the relationship with the God of my understanding is. I can't wait to hear more about this higher power. And the way I hear more about this higher power, sometimes it's, you know, that inner feeling. A lot of times it's from you. It's from listening to you share your story. It's listening about your life, the things that are going on. Because there isn't any one of us that's any more important There isn't any one of us that's any less important than the other one. That anonymity brings an incredible equalness to all of us. And so the seeking through prayer and meditation, it means, Kathy, just be aware. Because you never know where the answer is going to come from. Ever. And then it tells me, you know, what I pray for. Knowledge of God's will for me. Doesn't say, you know, make this huge long laundry list of all the things I want. You know, it doesn't talk about that. It talks about praying only for knowledge of God's will for me. And then the power to carry that out. And it's not a plea. You know, I bargained with God. Before I got here, and you know, there were brief times when I would think, well, maybe there's God. Just in case, I'm going to see if I can strike a little bargain here. You know, well, God can, you know, I'll do this if you'll do this and that kind of thing. That's not what this is about. The power to carry that out means that I do not have to bargain. And I do not have to worry about that power being there. Have you ever been just in the grips of fear and you just, you know, you're nervous or you're afraid or whatever and you're just shaking and all you want is for that to stop? And you can say a prayer or you can say, God, I'm afraid and I just don't know what to do. You know, God, I'm afraid, please remove the fear and show me what you would have me be. And then it goes away. Not about you, but I didn't do anything to make it go away. And so I don't have to worry about that power being there. I know that it's there. I love the things that this 11th step brings into my life. I love the things that it makes possible for me. I most especially love that it's an affirmation one more time that it's not up to me, that I'm not full of power, and that my ego does not have to be in control. Now, I don't know about you, for you all, but that's a great relief for me. And then the 12th step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs. If you're new to Al-Anon, or if you're new to AA even, if you're new to this program, if you want to know what you're going to get, what you're looking for, how you get it, and then what to do with it when you get it, all you have to do is look at the 12th step. When I came here, I wanted promises. I wanted facts, and I wanted promises right now. You know, I wanted that storybook, that dream world, right now. And it took me a while to recognize that in the 12th step, we have one of the most fantastic promises around. Because it says, having had a spiritual awakening. Didn't say that you had to come into Al-Anon in Burlington, North Carolina in February of 1969. Didn't say that. Doesn't say that you have to come in on a certain Tuesday, you know, the second Tuesday of the fourth month. It does not say that. It says, having had a spiritual awakening, when I came here, I felt completely different from you. It didn't make any difference what I had. When I had what you had, I never seemed to feel like you looked. That just never happened. I felt different. I was just, you know, it's like, I was just different. And this says, having had a spiritual awakening, there isn't anything that's different about me. And there isn't anything that says that I'm not going to have a spiritual awakening. I can have it. And I'm not different. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps lets me know exactly how it comes about. It lets me know exactly how it comes about. It lets me know exactly what to do to have it and where to turn. This step identifies my spiritual tools that I use in those 12 steps. And it says, carry the message to others. If this is truly a design for living, carrying the message to others means how I live my life. There are times. There isn't anything in this program that tells me that I'm not going to have anger. There isn't anything that tells me that I'm not going to have fear. There isn't anything that tells me that I'm not going to have frustration. Doesn't tell me that. But I will tell you the one thing I have not had since I've been here, and that's that utter hopelessness that I lived with. I haven't had that. This tells me that in carrying the message to others, when I have all of those things, I no longer have to express them the way that I did in the past. In the past, when I was angry, I would try to hurt you, and I would stop at nothing to try and hurt you. That's not the message that I have to carry anymore. Because when I'm angry, I now have something that I can do. I have a prayer that I can say. I have something to turn to. And then when it talks about practice these principles in all our affairs, one more time I have to tell you that I love the word practice. You know, this is like the hook for me. It's the hook that keeps me looking at all 12 of these steps. It's the hook that keeps me here. It's the thing that makes me want to come back time and time and time again. it's the thing that lets me know, you know, in the morning when I get up, why I want to do the things that I do, and at night why I want to do the things that I do. You know, that's what it's all about. I mean, it's that practice. It's that hook. My father died about 12 years ago, 11 years ago. And he died a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have to tell you that I do believe that that's a feat in itself. And in my mind, that's one of the greatest expressions of the very power of these fellowships when someone can die a sober member or an active member, be they an Al-Anon. And before he died, as he was sick, and as he was going through this terminal illness, he seemed to go through it without fear. And he seemed to go through it with an understanding that no matter what happened, he would be okay. And I'm reminded one more time of practice in this program, because my dad chose on a daily basis to practice what this program had to offer in his life. I shared with you that I didn't have a job when I came here. And I didn't. I've had a lot since I came here. And I have an excellent job now. Excellent career. And I never knew it was possible. And all I've done, you know, it's a little philosophy, is try to show up and be alert and change and go with the flow and pay attention to what I need to pay attention to. The greatest gift I can give back to this program, in my mind, is to try and be the best me that's possible, because I have a belief in my higher power. I do not believe that the God of my understanding tests me, nor do I believe that the God of my understanding challenges me. Because if that were the case, in my mind, I would still be out there dealing with active alcoholism and have absolutely no hope, have nowhere to turn, and have nothing to do. And I would be just stuck in that quagmire, and I would be stuck with that hopelessness, and I would have to live with that forever. I've had an opportunity to be in this program more than half of my life, and it's an opportunity that I'm extremely grateful for. Because when I think of all the things that have come along, when I think of the relationship that I have with the God of my understanding, you know, and when we talked about carry the message, that's the only message I have to share with you, is a message of what I have found as a result of this higher power. When I think about that, my breath is just literally taken away at times. It's like, I never expected this. When my mom said, keep your coat on, we might not like what they say, I never thought that I would be here. I never thought that I would have the opportunity to hear people share about their lives the way they have shared about their lives, and more importantly, I never thought I'd even care. Because when I came here, I did not have the ability, the capability to care about anything in anyone else's life. I didn't care. I did not care. And that was my favorite theme song, people would say, you know, and I would say, I don't care. I had no compassion for another human being. There's nothing I like more than watching or sharing or listening to what people have found in this program. You know, and given the opportunity, we will all share a tremendous amount with each other. And that's the thing, you know. Like I said, I don't even live in the same state where the rest of my family lives anymore. And yet I feel like there's a family right with me, wherever I am. And yet I know exactly why, on Wednesday night, when I go to my meeting, the Mesa Step and Tradition meeting, I know why I'm there. And I know what I'm there for. And I can't go in without the thought of, you know, thanks, God. Because we could have all been left out there without this. And I could have missed it. And thanks, God. You know, and it's just like being here this weekend. I've heard some tremendous things shared this weekend, and I have met some tremendous people this weekend. And it's all thanks, God. It's nice to be here. I want to close with this one thing. And this is from our little As We Understood book. And we have some incredible literature. And the names are, I mean, the titles of the books are, you know, The Courage to Change. I didn't have any courage when I came here. And it's like I had the ability to change my whole life. and I do want to thank you for letting me share this morning with you. The hope of this program is that no matter where we have been, no matter where we are, no matter how much we hurt, our lives can be transformed and our spirits can be healed. And I thank you for the transformation, and I thank you for the healing of my spirit.